The whole issue is designed to create a conflict which cannot be solved except by some world body. They will put two or three up there for you to vote on. All belong to them. They'll even make it like they're really against each other. They'll make you believe it. They'll even throw you some trash about one of them, so maybe you won't vote for him, thinking the election's fair because, that's not a moral person. And then who do you put in the White House? Most immoral person that ever lived on this planet.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to not the BCFM politics show. Well, we were arrested from BCFM back in March this year whilst I was out in New Zealand by the BCFM managing editor, Pat Hart. And we were told it was just a brief rest. We're now told that maybe we'll be back on the air in November, but don't hold your breath. We're certainly still going online. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and also Lib Dem councillor Tim Kent for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park here in Bristol. The Christchurch mosque massacre after in the second hour. The shooter is sentenced in New Zealand, but at his trial, nothing whatsoever about evidence that he had a lot of help in the actual operation. Evidence there in the sick video he took of the killings, which was streamed live on Facebook. So is that the end of the matter? No trial, no evidence, just a sentence. And protests in the United States as Trump accepts the Republican nomination. Also, great news about polio being eliminated in Africa. But what the BBC haven't told us is that the vaccine strain of polio is still killing and maiming thousands of people who probably wouldn't have been afflicted by it if they hadn't been vaccinated. Also, 5G here in Bristol. Freya Lockwood, who works for Bristol City Council, is paid for on our behalf to lobby for 5G, says it's safe. Dr. Deborah Davis begs to differ. She's from the Environmental Health Trust, and she's talking about mobile phones and cancer. What we often hear from the 5G industry lobby is that ionising radiation is not 5G. Well, they're quite right, but that doesn't mean to say that microwave radiation doesn't cause cancer. She says it does. Former Bank of England staffer turned scholar of the central banking industry. What he saw in there, Mohamed Rafiq was interviewed on this show back in 2012, but he's passed away last week. We go back to his look at the pearls of wisdom on what's really wrong with the banking system. A Bank of England staffer who converted to Islam. And we've heard of ISIS, the medieval cult of the assassins, a neo-Islamic cult designed to discredit the faith. And also, of course, the Christian Zionists of today and history's medieval Knights Templar, the world's first international bankers, fulfilling the same role, attaching themselves to the Christian faith. But what about the Kabbalists, the Jewish so-called mysticism? Few realise that Judaism is governed by two competing books of guidance, the Talmuds, one Jerusalem Talmud and the other from Babylon. That's where the ancient Kabbalah is thought to have come from. We hear from one of the world's scholars and authors on the topic, the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea, the Canadian David Livingstone. What are the true origins of the Kabbalistic Judaism? But that's in the second hour after six. First of all, joining me on the line is councillor, Lib Dem councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good afternoon, Tony.
Thank you for being our first councillor back after our hiatus, after having been hoofed off the airwaves and doing this show live as a live stream now. Obviously, it's obviously easy to get it on the internet afterwards and download it, etc., just as it was before. Can you just give us a brief outline of what's been going on over the last few months at the City Council? I know it's a very broad brush, but I mean, we're in a system, aren't we, where there was no election. Everyone was expecting there was people starting to gear up for a mayoral election back in May, but it never happened.
Well, that's right. In fact, I've just been cleaning out some election leaflets I had all printed ready to go, and then they got cancelled. I don't think that came as a massive shock, I've got to say. I think we could see that was likely to build up. That does now mean everyone's term of office has been extended by a year. personally, I would have much preferred the elections go ahead, but I understand that there was no way we could hold them. So since then, it's been a strange affair. We have shifted to online meetings. Now, as you know, I'm normally a big critic of Bristol City Council and in much of what it does, but I have to say that their transition to online meetings went far smoother and faster than the majority of other councils. So now you can have the joy of watching many of us on YouTube. It has opened up meetings far more to the public, as long, of course, you do have internet access. So for those who don't have that, they are currently excluded.
Okay, so in the old days, we say that, that's before March, basically.
Yeah.
The public had to actually come along to a meeting, but they could still see those meetings streamed live if they wanted to, couldn't they? And they could see archives of those on the council website. So there's more stuff which is being put up online now, is there?
So now virtual meetings are streamed live, as in where they're doing it anyway. So the general feeling is we should stream them live. Before that, maybe you saw a fifth of council meetings being streamed live. You would see the main full council meetings and cabinet meetings and an occasional other meeting. Now you will see all meetings that are public meetings should be actually put on our YouTube channel.
Okay, so the most important meetings, am I right in saying those are obviously there's a lot of money riding on the planning meetings, but I'm just talking about for the political and how our money is spent, our taxes, you know, the council tax, the business rate, etc., how that's spent. Am I right in saying that the most important meetings are simply the cabinet meetings and the full council meetings still?
Yeah, I would say predominantly, although obviously planning has a considerable effect on expenditure in the city, if an item gets passed or not. But yes, when it comes to the city's actual finances, probably cabinet in reality is where most of the money is decided on how it's spent in the city.
How's the cabinet system working? Because it's not quite the same as when we had a Lib Dem leader, Barbara Jenk, in charge, is it?
Well, unfortunately, I think everything that was predicted as potentially being wrong with the mayoral system has proved to be true. It's proved that too much power is in the hands of too few people. It is proved that that in fact oversight is less. Strangely enough, it appears that decision making has actually slowed down, which was something which I don't think anyone had expected to happen. I'm not too sure why that's happened.
Well, can you give us an example of something that's taken much longer under the mayor system?
Well, yeah, I mean, there could be loads of examples, but I guess the obvious example that will come to everyone's mind is the arena. There was the arena. The arena was pretty much ready to go for a full planning application, or not far off it, just before the mayoral elections in 2012. And then what do we see happen? We see one mayor spend his term get an application through. We then see the other mayor overturn that application. So that's just one example.
Well, hang on. I'm not sure I agree with you on that, because the arena is something that John Savage at Business West, when he was at Business West and the Cultural Development Partnership, where I came across him, he was banging on about this arena right the way to the early noughties. And I suppose you could say that it didn't happen in the noughties either. That's when we had the previous system too. So the arena, I mean, it was just a slow thing, whichever system way you look at it.
Well, that's fair enough. Well, let's take Hartcliffe Waste Centre then. Hartcliffe Waste Centre 2012, the money was put in the budget to deliver that. Now, admittedly, then the next mayor didn't want it. The mayor we have now has promised it in his first speech to council, yet we still wait. You know, another planning application's gone in. We've been told it will open next year. You know, still yet no diggers on site. So that's over 4 years wasted, but over 8 years since we made the decision to do that. And I think you can go throughout this where there have been decisions where things have been slowed down. We could take the plan to put solar panels on all 20,000-odd council houses across the council, all ready to go in 2011, 2012. New mayor comes in, project it gets delays, government funding scheme changes, schemes then ditched. 20,000 houses that could have had solar panels on now do not have solar panels on. So I think there's lots of cases where you could say, actually, the mayoral system, because it needs the approval of one person, and in fact, one person does not have that much time in the day to do that, slows down decision making, because ultimately all decisions have to go through one person, and they can't do that.
I always thought it'd be easier. Surely all Marvin Rees, the Labour mayor, has to do is just sign at the bottom of the page.
Well, in some cases, I think probably under the former mayor, Mayor Ferguson, there was a little bit more of just quickly trying to approve decisions. But I think under Marvin Rees, what we've seen is he can be quite slow in coming to a decision. I mean, if we take the arena, I mean, you sort of said that it'd been plagued with problems. That's true. But he did sit on the problem for over 2 years before he did anything about it. During that period, nearly £12 million of public money was spent. And then if we take the Bristol Energy problem, I mean, everybody else in this city could see Bristol Energy was going nowhere. They could see that 18 months ago, apart from Marvin Rees.
What about what's going on in the city centre? Because we've been seeing over the last couple of months some enormous changes, trying to keep cars out of the city centre. I think a lot of people feel around the city, particularly people who run takeaways, Tim, that this is really counterproductive. It's like we're trying to turn it into really just a pedestrian city. We've also seen all these bollards going in, and this is something I've seen over the last couple of weeks, turning two-lane roads, which are always pretty much congested, into one-lane roads, making even more congestion. It does seem as if the motorist is in the crosshairs here, and that the mayor is doing everything he can, really, to make the, you know, dissuade motorists from coming anywhere near the city centre now.
I think we're absolutely right to try to encourage people to shift to different forms of transport. Cities simply can't survive with the amount of motor cars that are pouring into them. And we also are aware of the issues of air pollution, of climate change. But there's a big but here. And my but is, especially coming from South Bristol, we do feel very aggrieved about some of the changes. One of the key ones for us would be the Bristol Bridge and closure of Baldwin Street. There's very, very few routes in from South Bristol into the city centre. I think there's about three. So that's one of them taken out. Now, what that means now is that more traffic will pile onto those already heavily congested roads, making them even more dangerous for cyclists, even more dangerous for pedestrians. Now, the truth is, you're always going to have to make a difficult decision here, and I accept that. And I understand the point of trying to sort of use this new norm, as people like to call it, to try to sort of speed up change. I'm all for that. But when you live out on the edges of the city, you're given very few options. Very few buses turn up. I mean, once again, I've had to submit another question to the mayor asking, where is our additional bus stop for the Bamfield and Metro bus that people were promised now 2 years ago? 2 years we've been waiting for one bus stop. That is it. I mean, that's what we wanted. We have very little in the way of access to cycle lanes and infrastructure like that. We have very, very poor bus provision on the edges of the city. So I perfectly get that those in the centre of the city want to see change accelerated. I support them in that belief. But what people need to understand is those of us on the outside of the city need to also be able to get in. And if you're going to move forward these changes, you need to also accelerate changes to public transport. And what we've seen under Marvin Rees is very little investment in public transport.
Well, that's right. I mean, the fares now, I mean, I can't believe it's £5 return to fish ponds on the bus. I mean, this is starting to get ridiculous, the fares that are being charged. And yet the mayor is patting first bus on the back, saying, well, what a great job they're doing.
I believe he patted them on the back the day they increased the fares. He even boasted about the new fare deal. This was a couple few years ago, I remember, when in fact the fares for those us for us out on the edges of the city were massively increased. And okay, a few people won with the fare change, but a vast majority of us on the fringes who do rely on public transport to get in and out. I mean, I try to use the bus where I can, and we want to see far more bus provision. And we also need to put in other interventions to try to reduce traffic at the city centre. We need to build park and rides, preferably smaller park and rides dotted around the edges of our city, to try to encourage people not to drive into the city and park, but, you know, to use public transport when they get into the more congested areas.
Martin Summers, you're a Labour Party member. This is a Labour mayor. For a lot of people, they're looking at for example, Bristol Bridge is the reason Bristol is here, apparently. That bridge is where the city formed around hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And now we're told, actually, vehicles are not going to be able to cross it.
Well, I'm not going to wade into all of this because I haven't got enough background information about what's being
decided.
Are
we just being curmudgeonly and saying we don't want change?
I think, as Tim rightly says, there's a general consensus that we want to reduce traffic in the city centre for all kinds of good reasons. Now, of course, as Tim's also rightly said, that requires difficult choices. And any change of something like this, there are going to be winners and losers.
Well, what about buses? Come on. I mean, you know, if you're going to say the cars can't come in, surely there's got to be a better bus provision.
The problem is that the mayor doesn't control what happens with buses.
We've got no tram system.
No. And indeed, in actual fact, we should have there should be a public...
In fact, you know what else we haven't got? We haven't got an underground either, which we were promised.
No, well, that's... what we really need to do is we should never have privatised the bus system in the 1980s. And so what happens is we're now picking up the pieces decades later of absolutely ridiculous policies that were imposed back in the day, and we've never changed them.
OK, well, Tim, I know you know that Tim Bowles is the Metro Mayor, and he takes quite a big role, doesn't he, in this transport policy. Has he been helping, or has he been twiddling his thumbs doing other things?
Well, I think a lot of people would question the role that Mayor Bowles does. He's definitely one of the lowest seen mayors in the country. I think he's wasted time. I mean, he was given new powers under the Bus Act. He could bring in a bus strategy. In that bus strategy, he could use bus franchising to take back control, at least, of the bus network. That wouldn't mean owning the buses, but it would control where they go, how much they charge, how frequent they are. It would set up a system similar to London. Now, I think that's a lot of what people wanted to see. We wanted to see that, you know, that bold vision, that big step change in public transport. Instead, we've seen absolutely nothing. And it's not just him, of course. Marvin Rees also sits on the West of England Combined Authority. He has a vote. He could have shown that leadership. We've asked him again and again and again to push this idea forward. I've got to say, an idea that was backed by the Labour Party quite often in their own manifestos for parliamentary elections. So I don't really understand why there's been such reluctance to use these new powers that we potentially have to really take control of the bus network and improve the bus network for the city.
Strange, isn't it? Anyway, the bizarre thing about Tim Bowles, of course, is that he's a Conservative mayor for a wider area, and it just seemed to me, Tim, that the whole thing was designed to make sure that there was some sort of... I mean, obviously, Bristol is a generally Labour city. To extend the boundaries out into the shires, outside the city, sort of 10, 20 miles surrounding, to take in all those Conservative rural voters so that there could be an alternative, kind of competition mayor to Marvin Rees or to whoever's a Labour incumbent in Bristol. But look, you know, you've also been looking quite closely at what's been going on with Bristol Energy. I know you mentioned it just now. This was an arm's length private company that was set up, I think, actually, probably by your administration, or was it George Ferguson, Tim?
Initially? Set up by George Ferguson.
So he was the previous mayor to Marvin Rees. It all started going horribly wrong, and right at the beginning of Marvin Rees's term as mayor in 2016, he was acknowledging that there were problems with it, but nothing's been done. And what kind of bill are we now looking at, having amounts of public money having been poured into this sinkhole of a company down the drain, effectively, in order to keep it going? And where's it all heading now, do you think?
Well, my estimate is that if, say, Bristol Energy was to wind up in the next few days, which really I would have thought the mayor would want that to occur, then what we will see is a bill of somewhere in the region of about £50 million to the public purse over the whole entirety of Bristol Energy being running.
And that's taking away any profits, the modest profits that they've made over that time. Actually, I'm not sure they have ever turned a profit, have they?
They've never made a profit. To be fair to Bristol Energy, one thing it has been is very consistent. It is lost £1 million a month. since launch.
Oh, my goodness. So what's happening now? Because I understand that they finally, Marvin, in his free year, before his possible re-election or maybe not re-election next May, he's decided he wants shot of this firm at last.
Following the cancellation of the elections, suddenly the mayor has now seen sense. I mean, I've got to say, a lot of us have questioned why millions and millions of pounds extra was decided to be put into Bristol Energy just before the elections were to occur. Many of us wonder whether or not that was simply to keep this company going so the truth of how much had been lost in it would not be part of the election campaign. But now the elections have been cancelled, the mayor has finally agreed that Bristol Energy should be wound up. We have sold the business element, so the business customers, the business book, has been sold to another energy company for somewhere in the region, I think it was about £1.5 million. That may sound, of course, like great news, but of course, the period that's taken to sell, we have probably lost that amount of money anyway in running Bristol Energy. They are still trying to sell the domestic customer book. That's somewhere probably just below 100,000 customers. Most of them are not in Bristol. Only 12% of Bristol's energy customers are actually in Bristol. They do need to get on and sell those because, of course, every day that ticks by, Bristol Energy racks up more losses.
It's not surprising then that over the last 3 years or so, when I've put requests in to Bristol Energy for comments and for them to put forward either their chief executive or one of their directors to be interviewed on the radio, every time, Tim, they've come back and they've either just simply not replied to my request or they've said, no, sorry, we won't be appearing.
Well, it's just unacceptable, isn't it? They're a company that is 100% publicly owned, so they are playing with council taxpayers' money, does not feel it's accountable to the public and the media. This is a problem, actually, we have discovered with councils running companies, is the secrecy that seems to surround these companies. I mean, secrecy has been sort of the key element, I think, of the mayoral system. Everything has become a lot more secret, but particularly around these private companies owned by the councils, they should be accountable to the public. One way for them to be accountable is through councillors, but also they should be directly accountable. And that includes, I believe, the senior management of these companies who have been paid exceptionally well and have performed well. I guess I'd say their performance is consistent. They have consistently lost money. People will have to decide, do they think the post of manager, managing director of Bristol Energy was really worth £250,000 a year.
Amazing. So £50 million down the drain. Let's move on and have a little look at the whole situation with special educational needs, because this is something where just a fraction of that amount of money would have enabled the City Council to be properly funding special needs children's education. What's been happening most recently with that, Tim?
Well, I expect a lot of your listeners are aware of the crisis that's within special educational needs. It's not completely unique to Bristol, but Bristol does now lead the local authorities as the worst performing with regards to special educational needs. And in that, one of the measures with that is the issuing of what's called education and health care plans, which is something you apply for. It replaced the old statement. They're supposed to be issued within 20 weeks. Bristol got themselves into a situation where not one single plan was being issued within the 20 weeks. And the average is now about a year it takes people to apply for these plans. So often when people apply for these plans, their child's life is already in crisis. Their school placement is already collapsing. There are probably significant issues at home and school.
And I'm also surprised, sorry to interrupt him, but I'm also surprised that the Education Service is not simply doing this for the parents. Well, I mean, I'm surprised to hear that the parents have got to almost like sort of go on some sort of website and go through forms, fill in various forms to apply for this. Surely, I mean, it's the responsibility of Bristol City Council to make sure children are educated to a reasonable standard.
As a parent, there's only one way to go through this process, that's to declare war. The only way you will win for your child is to declare war on the council. If you see it in any other way, you will fail. I just need to be very, very clear with people. If you're going to go down this route, it is a battle. If you treat it as a battle and you go in with that mentality, you will probably win. And that is what is wrong with the system, because, of course, that does mean middle class parents who can access very expensive legal advice, who themselves are educated, understand the forms and understand the law, are far more successful than those parents who do not already have those advantages in life. And that's what really gets me about the system, is how unfair it is, not just on children with special needs and disabilities, but how unfair it is on families which already face those problems.
Can you give us an idea of the sorts of warlike techniques then that the City Council uses to divert parents from and their children from actually getting what they really need?
Oh, well, OK, I can give you the worst examples if you really want them. I know of at least one parent who's been accused of child abuse falsely. I know of some parents who are told that a barrister is being appointed to oppose them at the small court tribunals when they're appealing the bad decisions by the council. And the council will send in a barrister to oppose them. Often, of course, the barrister has not received the brief from the council till the minute the meeting starts. So they're a bit of a joke when it comes to the tribunal. But still, that is a common thing. They will constantly make decisions that are unlawful. They will not specify the provision that they should do. They will constantly try to undermine the professional reports and leave out key information that should be included. I'm afraid you really must go into this with the mentality of these people are not my friends, and only then can you win. It sounds terrible. And as a councillor, I feel really bad that I need to say that's how you have to, one, treat your local council and, of course, those people who work for it. But if you don't do that, you will not win. I mean, the current situation now is that there is hundreds of people stuck in a queue waiting for the EHCPs to be determined. Those are several hundred plus. The 20 weeks period, the last report said 7% were done within the 20 weeks period. But what's clear is that those have been fast-tracked. They've jumped the queue. So those people in the queue are actually now waiting even longer because they fast-tracked a few applications to get them through. What is also clear is there are not enough special school places for people. So the council has just published their plan regarding special school places. It is to commit another £28 million capital money to mostly rebuild some of our special schools, but also to open some new places. That's to be welcome. But we need to be clear. It is not enough. There will not be enough special school places, nor will these special school places be delivered anywhere near in time. There's already around 190 children not able to access a special school place, even though they should be. And in the system, in that queue, are about another 250 children. So that is somewhere, that's in excess of 400 children who should currently be in special school, accessing the provision they need, and they're not.
That's pretty staggering, isn't it? Martin Summers, you're just about to probably be starting back working in schools again, aren't you, here in Bristol?
Yeah, and I often work with special needs kids. I mean, I think Tim would probably agree, the reason why the council is resistant to recognising these needs is because they have to find it from their own budget. There should be a national programme for looking after special needs in schools. And, of course, what you've got is...
But actually, it's more than that, isn't it? Because the council's actually doing central government's work for it. They're actively putting these people off.
Well, the point is that local councils, if they were in charge of all schools, as they used to be, remember we were talking about having the local authorities running the bus service, the local authorities, when I was a child, used to run the schools, all of them. And therefore, they mostly got their money from central government or from the rates, which, of course, is a property tax, which is much more equitable than the council tax. And ultimately, the council, the more people that they give recognition to the special needs of their children, they're going to have to cut that money from somewhere else in their budget.
Martin, they don't have to employ a barrister, do they? That's surely going to cost much more than it would to actually give provision to
okay,
a child.
It may be that this whole attitude of we've got to try and keep these people at bay is wrong, fundamentally wrong, but you can see why this has been set up. I think Tim could perhaps answer me if that's the case. The council, you're a councillor, the council is doing this because they're trying to save money because they haven't got enough money, and of course they're wasting on other things.
Yeah, let's ask Tim. Tim, I mean, Martin's basically saying there that actually they're doing this because these cuts have been imposed by central government.
I mostly agree with Martin there. I mean, to be fair, the budget is set by national government, so they set the budget for special educational needs. It is nearly always overspent, and you can imagine it is, I accept, it's a difficult position that officers are in. Having said that, some of the decisions they make lead to increased costs. I also think Martin's right, by the way, that it, by removing council's oversight and planning for local school provision, has really also created a massive schism in the system, especially when it comes to special educational needs. There used to be a lot more cooperation between special schools and local schools. There used to be a lot better, I think, special school provision. And a lot of that's had to go by the wayside, partly as part of the austerity cuts, partly to do with these very poor changes to removing local government oversight and control of education, which has left nobody in charge. And that's the reality of it. Nobody now really runs education locally. I mean, we do have, of course, ironically, the council is held to account, as in it must provide the school places, but it's been removed from having the powers to open a new school to do it.
Amazing.
So it is a bizarre.
Maybe they should just turn up with porter cabins or something to expand existing schools. How silly is that?
That is done in a lot. I'm afraid a big chunk of the special school plan is about expansions, literally just turning one office into a special needs room.
I mean,
is part of the plan.
What are you talking about there with the barristers coming in, that sort of thing? You know, intimidating, various different ways of cheating and intimidating parents with special needs children. Actually, it just sounds like they're dealing with some sort of cold, faceless corporation, you know, say Shell or something like that, Tim.
I think this is why what we've seen in the city over the last few years, that the development of the special educational needs campaigners, who are predominantly mums, who predominantly are the ones, I think, who have been challenging the system. That's why when you interview them, you detect that anger. And you also detect that that feeling of justice, that basically they are on a crusade. They did not start like that. It was them encountering the system that has turned them that way.
And it's like the survivor of the fittest going on here. Those that for whatever reason, their educational needs are challenged in one way or another, well, they can just fall by the wayside. That seems to be the attitude.
Well, yes, it has. But, of course, what the council have also created now are a bunch of very, very well-informed campaigners. So well-informed, they took the council to court and won. And they've made it very clear on social media in the last few days that they are planning to do the same again. They are fed up with the council having failed over provision of special school places. They've made it clear that the council is acting unlawfully, and they've made it clear that they are now going to prepare a legal case against the council, and we'll see them back in court.
Absolutely fascinating.
So I think the council needs to act fast. It's had a chance to try to work with parents and turn this around. And every time the parents think that, you know, there's going to be a turnaround, nothing seems to happen or things get worse. And, of course, we're aware that recently Bristol SEND department was inspected. So the Special Educational Needs Department was inspected by government, and it was failed. It has to now issue a written statement of action, which is done, which is its improvement plan.
I mean, the one thing that comes out of this for me is that I would like to see our mayor standing up and talking about this more and condemning central government, etc., but we don't see that. Anyway, one of the basic things going on in Bristol is our media. Tim, would you like to just, as a ballpark figure, rate our local media out on a score of 1 to 10?
I think I could happily give them an 8 or 9. That's not brown nosing. I actually think the local media is exceptionally good. We've got guys like you, Tony, in your program. We've got the local democracy reporters. I think they have been truly amazing at beginning to open up, particularly the council, having two dedicated reporters who report on council meetings, council business. So people sort of have an idea what the council are doing with their money. is good.
And of course, those local democracy reporters, Adam and Amanda, are both funded through the BBC budget. But as we're about to hear now from the former Home Affairs correspondent for Points West, Steve Brody, there is an enormous trench of cuts coming to the BBC right now.
My name is Steve Brody. I'm the former BBC Home Affairs correspondent here in the West Country. I was in newspapers before that, and then I worked in commercial radio, and then joined the BBC in radio as a producer, and ended up as a correspondent. The National Union of Journalists, obviously known as the NUJ, is a very old and well-established trade union. It had its heartlands in Fleet Street and went out into the regions. A very dignified trade union, and not often seen in the headlines, has a code of conduct about how to behave in a moral and proper manner, and is generally very well supported and well represented. Most journalists working in the regions, both in radio and television, are members of the NUJ. It's not a very big union, but it's very effective and has been a good watchdog over bad behaviour amongst journalists, especially in Fleet Street.
And also editors and managers.
Yes, indeed. When I was an editor in local radio, I was a member of the NUJ, and I've been a lifelong member of it. And you will frequently find people right up the management tiers being member of the NUJ.
What do the cuts or proposed cuts that the region here in Bristol mean for the people in Bristol in the West?
The effects are going to be widespread and damaging. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. For instance, the current affairs programme Inside Out West, based in Bristol with 12 or 13 people working for it, at least 50% of those have been asked to take voluntary redundancy. And it means, at the moment, Tony, throughout England and Wales, there are 11 regional Inside Out programmes. They're going to be cut from the 11 down to 6. For instance, here in the West, the programmes in Southampton and Plymouth are going to be axed. There'll be one programme, a half-an-hour programme on BBC One every week during the programme's run. That'll be based in Bristol, but there'll only be one story. At the moment, you have four or five stories per region, which, of course, is the whole idea of local journalism for local people. Focusing on local problems.
So what is Inside Out West doing that the Points West and the news is not?
Well, Inside Out West, of course, is a half-an-hour programme. So therefore you can do greater in-depth journalism. That's very important. Some complex things like corruption in banking, abuse, needs to have a proper amount of time to get to the bottom of it, to give both sides, to make sure that you're giving a balanced an in-depth report. You can't do that every night on Points West, who certainly do very good programmes, but Inside Out West does longer investigations throughout our area.
What about lunchtime and evening news programmes?
Well, I'm afraid these cuts outside Inside Out West, at Points West, will mean that both technical and journalistic staff are going to be made redundant. At the moment, there's an offer out to volunteer for voluntary redundancy. That has now closed. That closed last week. It means that there will be fewer journalists. For instance, it will also mean, instead of having two presenters at 18:30, familiar faces for many years in Bristol, like David Garmston and Alex Lovell, only one of those will survive. It means there'll be a change of style, and it will actually mean less stories. There will be less stories on the 18:30 programme. And that is very disappointing, and is certainly not to the benefit of the people in Bristol. Radio Bristol hasn't escaped either. One of the very oldest of local radio stations in the country. And it means their afternoon programme has gone. It's gone now. It went during the COVID pandemic, and they're not going to replace They're not going to bring it back. And it means that there will be only three programmes instead of four throughout the day. That itself is a very great shame. It cuts the voice of local people, which is what the BBC is about. It's about representing the public. And the public pay a licence fee, and they have the right for proper coverage. And these cuts certainly won't mean that.
I mean, hasn't the writing been on the wall for this for quite a long time? Inside Out West is only an occasional programme. It's been being eroded, hasn't it, for quite a long time, probably even decades.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure about that. We are peculiarly celebrating 50 years of BBC regional current affairs and local radio stations this year. Radio Bristol is 50 years old, for instance, this year. There was going to be a big party, and that's been abolished, sadly. Because I'm sure there have been some very familiar faces that could have come back for that. But the BBC has been under threat since David Cameron forced on the BBC a freeze of the licence fee. As we all know, a freeze is in fact a cut with inflation. And when David Cameron used his position to freeze the licence fee, which the BBC couldn't do anything about. I mean, the government is there to govern. And the BBC is independent of the government. People forget that. People think that the BBC should be there to produce government statements. Well, I've had 30-odd years in the BBC, and no member of the government has ever told me what to say. And that would be across the rest of the BBC. There is the argument, of course, that journalists in London get too close to members of Parliament or whatever. Well, they may do, but they still have the independence and the right to criticise. And that's absolutely fundamental, Tony, in a liberal democracy. You know, we are not living in a one-party state, although sometimes I feel possibly we are.
What about the NUJ? What's been their response? Can a union really do anything? Because the BBC have decided they're going to make these cuts.
Well, the NUJ can do quite a lot. There has been a union meeting called a chapel meeting, in which is an old printing term, in the BBC in recent weeks, a very well attended virtual meeting, of course, and a resolution was passed which calls on the BBC to stop this, absolutely to stop this. For instance, there will be fewer technical staff, fewer cameramen, fewer people working in the gallery where the programme is produced. There's absolutely no doubt that standards will go down. And there has been a very strong resolution. And I, to get this right, in case make sure that anybody thinks that I'm making it all up, there was a resolution passed in which it says that the NUJ understands the BBC has financial restraints. We don't live in laissez-faire. None of us do. There are people here who are listening and watching to this interview who are either on furlough or either have already been made redundant and will not get their jobs back because of the pandemic. We mustn't forget that. But what's happened to the BBC is that we've asked the BBC, it's urged the Director General, the outgoing Director General, Tony Hall, that the ratio of managers to staff is at the moment quite ludicrous. And we have asked, the NUJ has asked, I have to say here, I'm just speaking on behalf of the NUJ, it's not me, it's the National Union of Journalists that are making these requests, to prioritise programme makers, prioritise people who go out and report on the community, that's very important, and to maintain the trust in the BBC of the public. If the BBC doesn't deliver, it will lose trust. There's no doubt about that. We're saying that these cuts will affect the BBC's position in the country. It's a vital position, and it must be maintained. And at that union meeting, it was revealed that the 6,000 staff in the English regions, English and Wales regions, there are 6,000 staff. Of those, there are 17 senior managers who are paid between £150,000 and £327,000. And those salaries are equal to or greater than that of the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. And on top of these, there are a further 29 senior managers who could be earning anything from somewhere between £100,000 and £150,000 a year. Well, if you're spending that sort of money on these myriad layers of management, the NUJ's position is that is ridiculous and wrong, and that the money should be spent on reporting what is going on in our society.
What about members of Parliament? Is Parliament taking an interest?
Yes, they have. Both Labour and indeed Conservative MPs have written to Parliament complaining about this. After all, if you're the local MP and there's no local radio station, no BBC local station with the resources to allow you to come on and talk, you have no voice yourself. So MPs are concerned that they will lose their voice. And that's vitally important, that local people can talk through their local MPs. That is the point of having MPs. And it's interesting that broadcasters like Lenny Henry and Stephen Fry and a collection of well-known celebrities have written to the national newspapers and indeed to the BBC saying, stop this. This is a wrong decision which will have a damaging effect on how we talk to one another and how we talk to the government and people who represent us.
But they are persisting. I mean, it does seem as if there's a bit of conflict between central government and the BBC itself. Is that the case?
Yes. This is dangerous waters, of course. All governments throughout the history of the BBC since the 1920s, all governments, when they are in power, always feel that the BBC's got it wrong and don't like it. And in a way, I think that's actually right. The BBC should not be popular with governments of whatever colour, and that has certainly been the case here. Although one has to say, looking at the culture and indeed the fact that recent statements by people in power, like Dominic Cummings, who has made it, he certainly hasn't hidden his desire to destroy the BBC behind anything. He's come out and said, you know, we don't like the BBC. We'd rather there wasn't a BBC. And of course, historically, people like the Murdoch Press and indeed Associated Newspapers, publishers of the Daily Mail, have always attacked the BBC. They've attacked them for the very good reasons that they are competitors, and the BBC mostly has employed the best journalists in the country, and it is in their interests to see the BBC minimalised, perhaps, or destroyed altogether.
Well, they will say, won't they, that the commercial broadcasters like Sky can do it just as well.
Really? Is that true? Give me one story that Sky has broken in the last decade of some magnitude. You can't, because they haven't. What Sky does is very professional, absolutely, there's no question of that whatsoever. How many stories a day do they do? Tell me.
How many will get their stories, as you do, from the newspapers?
I don't think so. I don't think I've ever got a story from a newspaper, actually, Tony. I do my own research, and my colleagues do, and especially at BBC Points West, where people do research themselves. People like Matthew Hill, the health correspondent, Charlotte Callum, the home affairs correspondent, people like Clinton Rogers in Somerset. The very idea that he got a story, come on, that's why we're at the BBC. We go and find stories. Dave Harvey, the business correspondent, doesn't get it out of the local newspaper, goes and finds it himself. And if he doesn't, he jolly well should. Well, correspondents, people like me when I was working there, are paid to find their own stories. That's your role. You can't just come in and say, oh, it's in the Evening Post, let's do the story. I'm not saying that reporters don't do that, but correspondents are paid to go and find their own stories, and so they should. And that is why the BBC is very successful. But looking at it globally, as it were, certainly locally, look what's happened at the Evening Post. There have been redundancies at the Evening Post. I remember coming to Bristol 30-odd years ago. The Evening Post had 50, 60 pages. It had probably had 50 journalists. There are now two correspondents on the Evening Post. one of whom is actually paid for by the BBC, because the BBC pays for local government reporters. And that's one of their two correspondents, and that is provided by the BBC. And that is a pretty astonishing thing, that the BBC, in its time of travail, is still supporting local journalists, it's still providing a job for somebody to work at the Evening Post, which I think is a very good thing.
So what are the BBC themselves saying about all this?
Well, I obviously cannot speak for the BBC. That would be entirely wrong. You must ask them yourself, Tony, what they think. But I do remember a senior manager, and I've got to get this right, obviously, because you know senior managers don't like to be misquoted, but a senior management said that the BBC's local and regional services were created 50 years ago, as I mentioned. It's the birthday, the anniversary of Radio Bristol. And she said, despite their extraordinary skills, they need significant reinvention. How do you reinvent the wheel? What's wrong with them? Why doesn't she like them as they are? Kate Adie started on BBC Radio Bristol. Didn't do too badly. Why do we need any reinvention? So I have no idea.
Just to sum up, if these cuts do go through, what do it mean for viewers and listeners?
Well, Inside Out, obviously, will be unrecognisable, which is a great shame. That will be totally unrecognisable. One story a week from the whole of the southwest. Somebody living on the tip of Cornwall is not going to be interested in what's happening in Eastern and vice versa, unless it's a world-shaking story. And despite our best efforts as journalists, we don't come up with world-shaking stories every day, much as we would like to, but we don't. So therefore, people in these areas will lose their voice. They won't actually see stories about Eastern, about what's happening in Bristol Crown Court, what's happening with Avon and Somerset Police. We won't, because it won't get on. And I forgot to tell you that the new Inside Out will be edited in Birmingham. Well, please, that is not local. That is not what the BBC is about.
How about radio?
Well, there is this argument that lots of people now get their news by looking at their iPhone. And that is an argument. That the world has changed. And there's no doubt about it. There's nothing wrong with digital journalism at all. In fact, as part of these restructuring in Bristol, there will be more digital journalists. You will see more digital work. There's nothing in itself wrong with that. There's some great digital work done on the BBC online service. And if that goes, then you will struggle. You really will struggle. National newspapers are getting smaller. Most of them are now tabloids. The Guardian, the Evening Standard in London, is making 150 journalists redundant, owned by a Russian oligarch, friend of Boris Johnson. The Guardian, at the other end of the scale, as it were, the other end of the political scale, perhaps, is set to make journalists redundant. It's not just the BBC. And if we're not careful, we will not have an independent and powerful organisation to take on the big players, the big corporations, people like Donald Trump. You need proper journalists to take them on. If you don't have them, we're going to be in a very sad place. And a final point, Tony, and this is probably not known by many people, but programmes like Points West, like BBC Points West, put on audience. They put on extra people watching after the BBC flagships like the 6 o'clock news and the 10 o'clock news. The bulletins after them, the audience goes up. Little known fact. And the BBC should put its hands up and say, that's what we do. But of course, the BBC doesn't do that. It's one of those wonderful organisations that doesn't boast about itself. And it needs some champions, and I'm certainly one of them.
Well, that's Steve Brodie there. He's the former BBC Home Affairs correspondent, speaking to me earlier this week about the cuts, Tim. This is looking pretty grim. The local documentary series, Inside Out Points West, is going to be massively denuded, and also it's not going to be a Bristol programme anymore, it's going to be a Birmingham show.
Well, I think a lot of people would say that they would want to see even more local news over there, BBC, even more locally based, not put into these super regions. I think the work that we see come out of the local BBC programmes so far has always been exceptional. I've always been truly amazed at the work ethic of the journalists, their fairness. They're willing to challenge and stand up to the powers that be to help uncover where things are wrong and to champion where things are great. And I do worry that the BBC are making the wrong decision. And I think actually it was an interesting point there about the big salaries. I'm afraid we see this in local government as well, the constant expansion of big salaries. We've seen this at Bristol over the last several years. There
well,
are now
actually,
far more people
yeah.
and bigger
I
salaries.
Mean, if you do those that crunch the numbers for these 46 very highly paid senior managers in BBC nations and regions, instead of those 46 people who never appear on air, for example, they're not doing any kind of actual production work or whatever. So, you know, if they were to go on holiday for a year, very unlikely that anyone would even notice. That would be the equivalent of something like 400 full-time jobs.
I imagine it would be, because the other thing we all know is journalism is not a very well-paid profession. So the reality is a lot of the people who are out there doing the hard work are doing it not at great pay, and that's particularly the case for, you know, in the newspaper industry, for people like the Post journalists and all work on considerably lower salaries than really what they should be entitled to.
Just chatting to Steve, he was saying that one of the consultants is a full-time person working for Nations and Regions who's on around about £150,000. They actually did a freedom of information request to the BBC, the NUJ did, and they found out that this chap was doing event coordination. And, of course, he's been being paid full-time for doing absolutely nothing because there haven't been any events.
It's all right for those that can get it, isn't it? But that's not what our public services are there for. And although the BBC are a sort of independent public service, they are a public service. And I think, to be honest, a lot of the public are now getting fed up of what they see as excessive wages for managers at the top, who often actually are not that specialist in what they're doing. And we want to see far more emphasis on that money being put back into the front line. Journalists and services. I am quite worried about some of what I heard there. It was actually a lot more detail than I had than I knew before from that interview. I hadn't fully realised how deep the cuts were going to go. And I think maybe this should be something that Bristol City Council should be debating. But of course, as we know, our current mayor prefers to attack local journalists rather than support them.
Well, that's a great pity. Martin, what do you make of this attack on the BBC? Because this is by central government, not by Marvin Rees as the mayor, as Tim was just hinting there. The government really seems to be saying that, well, we've had enough of this. We're going to freeze the licence fee. We don't like the idea of public service broadcasting at all.
I think Dominic Cummings would totally agree with you 100%. And as
well, why? Why is it?
Because it's an alternative voice. What they want is a commercial setup. Commercial everything, and that's why the salaries are so big. They're equivalent to the salaries of people working in the private sector at that sort of level, and they want the public services to be made user friendly to the commercial sector, and ultimately, of course, get rid of public service sector. You know, I mean, in the United States of America, you don't have anything like the BBC. You've got the PBS, but it's, you know, a minor thing, and basically everything's
commercial.
Well,
you do. You have, there's this thing called C-SPAN, which is similar.
It's not the same thing, is it?
What the BBC do, and as Steve was pointing out there, is they're actively going out sourcing stories all the time, which is actually quite a time-consuming and expensive operation.
Well, it is, and of course, what it leads to is you know, when it's working properly, is they expose all sorts of things that Conservative and other governments don't want to talk about.
I wonder, both you, Tim, and you, Martin, isn't the BBC kind of had it really? Because every single government that comes along, its independence demands that it opposes that government and it challenges that government, and the government itself is now in a sort of Peter Mandelson type situation. I remember working at the BBC in London. We used to joke about Peter Mandelson. He was the Labour peer he actually was a Labour MP at the time, would phone up editors and say, I'm going to get you, or if he'd phone up journalists and say, look, if you don't lay off, I'm going to get you sacked because I know your editor. This seems to be happening more and more. We've also seen during the pandemic, the afternoon programme on Radio Bristol being cut due to the pandemic, but them not being restored. On the BBC World Service, we've seen World Update, one of the best programmes on the World Service, with Dan Damon, a daily review of the world's news for an hour in the mornings, at least in the UK, GMT mornings, that being axed due to the pandemic and then never being put back again. And of course, we've had the same sort of experience with Bristol Community Radio, even little tiny Bristol Community Radio using the pandemic as a reason to get rid of us and then not restoring the show. So it does seem as if there are moves, doesn't it, Tim, to actually moves on independent journalism, not just in the city, but in the wider world.
Well, I think the greater threat to the BBC is probably the streaming services. And the thing the BBC have got that can fight back against that is their journalism, is their news, is their public service broadcasting. And of course, if that is undermined, you're quite right, then their whole purpose is dug away at, is undermined, and then it's easier for the government to get rid of them. I personally think it would be a very, very brave government to try to scrap the BBC. I think the vast majority of the public want to keep the BBC as is. And I personally think the BBC are making the wrong decision on cutting regional programmes.
Yeah, well,
I realise they want to put more into the digital world, but I think, you know, there's other places they need to look. And I think they need to consider what is their core purpose and concentrate on that. And part of that core purpose is its local news broadcasting and local public service shows. And that's where I think they should be putting their money and not trying to necessarily compete with the big streaming services. Mm-hmm. I think that is a recipe for disaster.
Well, there's an enormous difference between the regional BBC, which we are talking about here, Steve Brodie's Points West, BBC West correspondent, and the national BBC. I don't think the national BBC is anywhere near as popular as regional. And in fact, as he was pointing out there, Martin, he's saying what they do every evening, every weekday evening. In fact, it's weekends too, isn't it? They have a national bulletin at 6 p.m. and then there's a regional bulletin that comes just after it. He's saying that the regional bulletin is actually picking up audience. So people are not interested in hearing the BBC London news. They're much more interested in hearing what the White Ladies Road here in Bristol's producing every evening.
Well, that's obviously a unique selling proposition, isn't it? Very different from, you know, you can get main news from any outlet, but the local news is local. And, of course, you mentioned the World Service there. That's actually funded by the Foreign Office. And you could argue, and if I was Vladimir Putin, I might, that therefore it's basically British government propaganda at the taxpayers' expense. I don't think it is, but it's funny, isn't it, that when other countries have their national broadcasters, like RT and so on, that's regarded as some kind of terrible thing.
Well,
but when we do it, that's okay.
Well, look, if George Orwell was sitting around this table with us, Martin, he probably would say it is British propaganda, actually, the World Service, especially since we now hear lots more American programmes, American correspondents, so-called BBC correspondents, American interviewees. It almost seems like it's just an outpost of Washington, the World Service now.
Well, indeed. Well, the case I'm making is that you've got to recognise that everything has to be funded by somebody, and what you really want is editorial independence. I mean, that's the key to everything, isn't
okay,
it?
OK, well, anyway, look, just a couple more stories to go. We'll squeeze them into this slightly extended hour. Sorry, folks. It's the other thing of this week we must discuss is this whole business of the BBC banning the singing of Land of Hope and Glory. Before we hear from the former Director General, Michael Grade, who also was the boss of Channel 4 for a long time, what do you make of this, Tim? Is this a bit of political correctness gone too far? They're saying that, next year people will be allowed to sing Land of Hope and Glory or Royal Britannia.
Well, it was my understanding that a decision was made regarding COVID. It was nothing to do with the song, but it was to do with singing. And
okay,
the
do you believe
possible,
that? Do you believe
infection.
That? Do you believe that?
Yes, I probably do believe that. I believe certain right-wing politicians have grabbed hold of this story and have spread it to try to detract from their utter uselessness at leading this country.
Okay, Martin, what do you make of... are you there singing Royal Britannia at the last night of every proms?
Well, I think I'd rather... I tend to agree with what Tim said. I mean, it's been turned into a confected thing with Piers Morgan on the Sky or wherever it is going on about that they're trying to get rid of Land of Hope and Glory, etc.
Well, it's not been turned into anything, has it? Because it's a tradition that's been going on since Henry Wood started.
No, I know, but I mean, the point, as Tim Penn, the reason they're not having singing is because you can't have singing in churches. Yeah?
Singing. Is that right?
Well, in COVID, because it's a COVID measure. But what's happened is it's been picked up by the right-wing press and by politicians because they want to have a culture war about it. I don't care.
Surely it's also been picked up by people who enjoy the last night of the proms.
Well, in actual fact, I listen to the proms a lot. And in actual fact, the last night of the proms, the people who turn up for that are the people who are actually not that interested in music. But that's another story. Well, people are allowed to sing whatever they like. And of course, this is basically a confected. Next year, they're all going to be belting it out as before.
Tim,
and the question is still going to be whether going to be allowed to do it.
I am instinctively opposed to nationalism. Broad brush. I mean, that kind of my country's better than your country position, I'm wary of. But I am not against love of country. Mm. I am very much a lover of country. And I am patriotic in that sense. And my patriotism extends to the whole of the British Isles. I consider myself British. And I love the whole place. I say this over and over again, and I won't back down from it. The welcome that I've had in England, Ireland, Scotland, and Wales has always been. And I love the place. The work that I've done, the books I've written, the television programmes I've taken part in, I think have been celebratory, where possible, and always alive, weight to the idea that history is a story, a long story of light and shade, and you discuss the good and the bad, and you move forward constantly. But underlying it all for me is love of country, and this thing about Rule Britannia and Land of Hope and Glory, I think especially at the moment when people are under so much pressure. Emotionally and economically with everything that's been going on with the lockdown and all of the sort of internecine trouble that's been there. And people have lost a great deal. Some people have lost loved ones. Certainly lots of people have lost liberties and they're looking at an uncertain future and losing jobs and all the rest of it. And to take away more from people and to contemplate taking away singing, I don't believe many people, if any people, sing, join in with Land of Hope and Glory because they're wanting to celebrate slavery or that kind of angry triumphalism. Mm. It's a rattling good tune and it's great choruses for both songs. And when I used to watch it. I've never been in the Royal Albert Hall, but I've watched the last night of the proms often and just smiled. I don't think you can. If you're open-hearted, I don't think you can do but smile when you see people of all ages and from all backgrounds just singing their lungs out.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, singing is an expression of joy. And if there's one thing that we need as much as possible at the moment, it's for opportunities for people to come together joyously. And for the vast majority of people who would sing that song at that in that place and time, they're just wanting to express joy and to contemplate taking that away. And I think if as a person, when you look on at the world and if you look on at individuals and all you see is ugliness and evil and darkness, then you have to remember that that's you.
Mm.
You are projecting onto the world around you the darkness in your own heart. And if you think that people are only singing songs and only doing things because of an ugliness inside, then it's your own ugliness that you're projecting onto the world there. And just leave people in troubled times to find a bit of joy where they can.
Yeah.
Tim, is Royal Britannia racist? What do you think?
I don't think it's racist. I think that the thing is, with any song of its day, it obviously puts forward the views of the people of that point. It is obviously very jingoistic. It is very much about how great Britain is. And on occasion, do you know what? That is not a problem. I don't think we want to be constantly policing ourselves and leave ourselves with zero fun. I think what we do need to do is sing a lot more Trelawney and Cornish songs there. I think that would be great.
So
there's a great line in Trelawney about how the Cornish are killing the English, by the way.
Yes, that's
I think that should be banned.
It's like the Irish National Anthem, the Soldiers' Song. They changed it for what's it called, the one they sing now?
You can think about that, Martin. I'm trying to remember it, whilst I just remind people that of the absolutely hilarious first lines of Land of Hope and Glory. I know it's Royal Britannia, isn't it? Is Royal Britannia, Britannia rules the waves, Britons never, never, never shall be slaves. Well, obviously, Britannia does not rule the waves, and so there's got to be a little bit of a smile when people are singing that. I suppose they're hearkening back to the days of empire, and actually ruling the waves really meant going round and bombing and destroying using your naval cannons any of your enemies, didn't it?
Gunboat diplomacy.
I'll put the lyrics up, actually, I think, on our show page, because just reading through them, they definitely don't seem to be negative. They seem to say things like, well, where the British Empire goes, commerce is good, and that sort of thing.
I think one of the things that people have picked up on, and Britons never shall be slaves, that was written in the 1740s, and of course the slave trade was going great guns at that stage, and therefore Britons, i.e. white people from Britain, are never going to be slaves, but our ships are quite happily taking slaves across the Atlantic as we sink.
Didn't Britain actually play quite an important role in ending the slave trade? There were many other European nations that were doing the slave trade at the time, weren't
there? Yeah, well, they did, but don't forget, we were the ones who pioneered it, but certainly in the 1740s, when that song was written, it was basically the case that, Britain was still the major slaving country. And, of course, a lot of it is actually directed at the Scots, because, of course, in the 1740s, they were just about to rebel.
There's obviously a bit of hypocrisy in this Royal Britannia, definitely.
That line could also hark back to the period before that. Admittedly, it is before that. It's more in the 17th century, but it was not uncommon then for people, certainly on the Cornish and southern coast, to be kidnapped by pirates. Yeah. It happened a lot in the late
Barbary
17th
pirates,
century. And then someone would be sent off to buy them back. Quite often they would get them back because they'd be held for ransom more than anything. But Britain had completely lost control of the waves, ironically, in the late 1600s. Mm. And that was the turnaround, I think, actually, it was sort of. And so there may be a little bit of that going on. You know, we now rule the waves and we won't be your slaves is perhaps what they're trying to scream.
Well,
out.
Nowadays, the United States, I don't know if they rule the waves. They certainly rule the air. US B-52 bombers are back in Britain, escalating nuclear tension, according to the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament this week. Six US Air Force B-52 bombers arrived at RAF Fairford on Saturday. Official sources describe it as a long-planned training mission carrying out theatre and flight training across Europe and Africa. But local news site Gloucestershire Live describes it as a surprise deployment. The much-respected expert Hans Christensen from the Federation of American Scientists posted a picture of six bombers on Twitter describing it as a pointed message to Russia. He went on to note the interesting timing of the deployment given what's happening in Belarus, observing that these exercises normally take place over Poland and the Baltic states, who are Belarus's neighbours. So there are certainly some people pointing to this, Martin, as a geostrategic move, bringing these B-52s over to Gloucestershire by the Americans.
Well, the idea that we're going to have a nuclear war over political disputes in Belarus is rather alarming.
But these can carry conventional weapons too, can't they?
Well, even a conventional war. I mean, basically, do we need to have American bases here dragging us into conflicts with other people? I would be with that Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament on this. Maybe we should just be like Switzerland and mind our own business, eh?
Or maybe like New Zealand and just say, we're not having anything here that might be nuclear. The Americans then say, mm-hmm. we're not going to tell you whether it's nuclear or not. So the New Zealanders then say, well, you're not having anything here then. In fact, I was chatting to someone over there, Tim, when I was over there earlier this year, and they were saying, well, when the United States aircraft come to air displays in New Zealand, they're not allowed to land. So they have to come from some Pacific island, fly over to New Zealand, fly around, and then fly off again, because the Americans refuse to say what does and doesn't carry nuclear weapons. Anyway, what do you make of this arrival of these B-52s in Gloucestershire?
Now, normally, Tony, I don't normally buy into your conspiracy theories, and I've got to say I'm probably not going to buy into this. I think sometimes we put a little bit too much faith into the competence of our superpowers. I don't think there's any way they'd be able to organise 6 B-52 bombers over here within a week of Belarus being in crisis. I also think that actually Donald Trump does not give two hoots about Belarus and probably would not be able to find it on a map in a month of Sundays. I also agree that there's no way we would go to war over Belarus. I do feel that we should do what we can within reason to support the people of Belarus to demand legitimate, open, free government. And of course, as we know, that's not what Mr. Putin wants in Belarus. But I think very clearly Belarus is in the Russian circle, and anyone in the West is treading very, very carefully when it comes to Belarus. So I suspect it is, as said, it was a long-standing training mission. If they'd had any sense, they would have cancelled it, knowing the timing. But they don't have any sense, and that's why it went ahead.
Well, Councillor Tim Kent, Lib Dem for Whitchurch Park, thanks very much for joining us on the first hour of the Not the BCFM Politics Show. We're going to finish, though, with just Martin to comment on this. And this is Michael Grade, Sir Michael Grade, in fact, who's a former chairman. He wasn't the chairman of the BBC. He was the director general, who is the editorial chief of the BBC. And his comment on the pulling of Rule Britannia and similar songs from the last night of the proms.
It demonstrates really how out of touch they are with their core audience. Anything more designed to upset the core BBC fans, the people who love the proms, than coming up with this ridiculous idea of not singing the lyrics to Rule Britannia is just beggar's belief. It's just idiotic, really. I don't think there's any plausible explanation for dropping the lyrics. It's just too woke to be believable, frankly. It's classic BBC talking to itself and not understanding the public mood and public attitudes.
Michael Grade says it's implausible.
Well, as I understand it, nobody's allowed to sing, not in churches, not
we might. La, 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 la.
Yes, well, there we are. Well, you're singing now, but the question is, this is being whipped up by those, like the kind of people who thought that when we tipped Colston's statue into the river, we wanted to tear down the cenotaph. You've got people who are making a big deal out of this. I was going to mention earlier.
Who said that?
Well,
the far right might have done.
The far right, that's exactly what the far right is saying. I'm not opposed to people singing Rule Britannia and...
But you seem to be implying that people that sing Rule Britannia are from the far right.
No, they could be. I mean, Britain First have a logo with Rule Britannia on the bottom of it. So they certainly sing it, but that doesn't mean that everybody who sings it is a fascist.
Oh, well, I'm glad about that. It's nice to hear that opinion from you, Martin. Anyway, so we are going to be back in a minute. That was Tim Kent from the Bristol Lib Dems and Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. We'll be back after some music.
Oh, no!
The Democrat proposed Bill H.R. 6666.